And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive beaten for the light, to cause the lamp to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations. The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Our program today, The Mother Tongue, was written by Harold Flender and is the first in a series entitled A Yiddish Omnibus.
Hello. I'd like to tell you something about my language. My language is Yiddish, and I think I know something about it because I've been speaking it for over 1,000 years. Yes, for over 1,000 years I've been speaking Yiddish all over the world, wherever there are Jews. Throughout the centuries, it's a language I've used in everyday speech. When it came to religion, to praying, for using language for sacred purposes, why, then I'd use Hebrew. But for everyday, ordinary speech, it's always been Yiddish.
Wake up!
What?
You heard him. Wake up.
What do you want?
We just think you ought to wake up to the fact that your days are numbered.
Fewer and fewer people speak Yiddish these days.
It's a language without a future.
Wake up! Face the fact that your days are numbered.
You're finished.
What do you mean, finished?
Finished is finished. Or, as they say in Yiddish, fartig. Face it. You're fartig, finished, washed up.
Who even studies Yiddish today? It's a dying language.
Yiddish, a dying language. Yiddish, affectionately called Mama Loshon, or the mother tongue. To equate a language with motherhood was considered the highest form of compliment. Of course, this was long before Freud and psychoanalysis. I can't believe its days are numbered. I mean, when you know its story, when you see all it's been through. Since so many words in Yiddish come from other languages, no one can really be absolutely certain of the derivation of all Yiddish words. Sometimes you find several conflicting theories about where a certain word comes from. I'll tell you some of the theories, but well, please keep in mind that they are only theories. As to the place where Yiddish originated, there seems to be little doubt. It started in the Rhineland in Germany in the Middle Ages. We had come to Germany from France and northern Italy. Before the 9th century, we spoke Hebrew, Aramaic, Greek, and Latin. And then, using as its basis the German spoken in the 9th century, we developed our own language and called it Yiddish.
B'chol ha'olam yeshe medabrim Yiddish.
That's Hebrew.
Über der ganzen Welt redet man Yiddish.
That is Yiddish. The two languages don't sound alike, but they look alike because Yiddish uses the basic 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. When we Jews living in Germany in the Middle Ages decided to have a written form of our new language, it was only natural for us to employ the letters of one of the languages we already knew, Hebrew. Now, Hebrew was a particularly good choice because it is largely a phonetic language. The letters always sound the same. He is always pronounced H, and Gimel is G, G. It's not like English, where the letter G can be pronounced like a hard G, as in great, or a soft G, as in large, or as an F, as in laugh. In Hebrew, Lamed is always L, U, and Tzadik, Tz. This is the same in Hebrew or Yiddish. Yiddish, like Hebrew, is written and read from right to left. Books and newspapers, therefore, begin at the back, from the English point of view. Paragraphs are indented on the right. Pages are numbered backwards. There are no capital letters in Yiddish. The significant difference between Hebrew and Yiddish is that in Hebrew, all letters are consonants, and vowels are written only in the form of punctuation marks. In Yiddish, some letters are used as vowels. For example, ayin, which is silent in Hebrew, is pronounced eh. In Yiddish. Because Yiddish originated in Germany, almost 80% of the Yiddish vocabulary is of German origin. For example, take the Yiddish word kibitzer.
Piggy! Piggy! Piggy!
What's that?
Piggy! Piggy! Piggy!
What are you doing?
I'm a bird watcher. I'm trying to call the kibitz.
Der kibitz?
Yes, yes. The kibitz is a small bird found in this part of the country that makes a shrill, annoying sound like this. Piggy! Piggy! Piggy!
And from the German word kibitz, the name of a bird, came the Yiddish word kibitzer. Now, come to think of it, the kibitzer is also a bird that makes shrill, annoying sounds. A people's vocabulary is often a clue to their character. Now, to show you what I mean, let's go into this German cafe and ask a few questions. Yes, now, pardon me, sir.
Yeah?
Could you tell me something about the German word König?
The König means king. And it is where the English word comes from. König, king.
Uh-huh. And what is the word for what a king does when he rules? That is, reigns. What is your verb to reign?
That is regieren.
Regieren. That means to reign, but it also implies...
To dominate.
To dominate?
Exactly. To reign is to dominate.
Well, this typical German concept, to reign equals to dominate, was not acceptable to us. So, we created our own verb from the German word König. It was königen, which meant simply to reign with no implication of domination. The word schlimmmazel is a word we made up from German and Hebrew. Mazel in Hebrew means luck. Schlimm is a German word meaning bad. Schlimmmazel, bad luck. And one who is constantly having bad luck, often through no fault of his own, we call a schlimmmazel. Sometimes the word schlimmmazel is confused with the word schlemiel, which means an awkward person who does stupid things. There is a difference.
Waiter! Waiter! Where is my soup?
Here it comes. But you better watch it. The soup is very hot. Maybe you better move so I can put it down on the table.
I will not move. You just be careful the way you put it down. Very careful. Now look what you've done. All over my coat. Schlemiel.
I told you to move, schlimmmazel.
You see the difference? The schlemiel pours the soup on the schlimmmazel. In the 13th and 14th centuries, there were persecutions of the Jews in Germany, and many of us left the country for Czechoslovakia. We took with us not only German words, but words we had brought with us from France and Italy.
Oh, look at that young girl over there. Elle est belle, no?
Oui, elle est belle, très belle.
And from the French word belle, which means beautiful, we made up the word bella, which means beauty. The word yenta comes from France, too. You've heard of the French word gentille? It means pleasing, nice. And in Old French, the G was pronounced like a Y.
Elle est gentille.
Très gentille.
Oh.
And from the French word gentille, we made yenta, originally using it as a term of endearment. Later, it became a term of opprobrium. One of the more popular Yiddish expressions is Baba Misa, or grandmother's tale. It refers to a fanciful story or bit of superstitious nonsense, and oddly enough, it entered the Yiddish language from Italy.
And I take full credit for it. My name is Elijah Bohor. I moved to Italy from Germany around 1500... and served in Rome as Hebrew tutor to Cardinal Egidio da Viterbo. And while in Rome, I discovered the long romantic poems of the Renaissance. These inspired me to write a book-length poem in Yiddish, patterned after the Italian romances. It told of the fantastic doings of one Buova d'Antona. It was published in 1507 and became known as the Bova Buch.
Stories about the wild adventures of the main character in the book became known as Bova Mises, the word Misa meaning story in Hebrew. Later we began applying this term, Bova Misa, to all sorts of fantastic tales and superstitious nonsense. And still later, the term evolved to Boba Misa, or grandmother's tale. The vast majority of us who wanted to escape the persecutions in Germany did not move back to France or Italy, but moved eastward to Prague in Czechoslovakia. And here, Slavic words began entering our language. The proportions vary from country to country, but generally speaking, Yiddish consists of about 80% German words, 10% Hebrew words, 8% Slavic words, and 3% of words from other languages, including, as we will see later on, English words. In other words, it's a typical language, because all languages borrow from other languages and give to other languages. Anyway, it was in Prague that Slavic words began entering the Yiddish language.
My luck. I had to marry a man who's a nebogi.
A what?
A nebogi. If my husband is not a nebogi, then I don't know the meaning of the word nebogi.
Now, could you be kind enough to tell me the meaning of the word nebogi?
All you have to do is look at my husband to understand the word. It's a perfectly good old Czech word. It means one who is poor and completely powerless soul. Just look at my husband. Wouldn't you call him a nebogi?
Well, we called him something like that. We called him a nebuch. Later, when we got to America, we changed it to nebish. So whenever you hear us use the word nebuch or nebish, you'll know that we took it from the Czech word nebogi, from the time when we lived in Prague. In the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries, we migrated from Czechoslovakia to Poland, and Polish words began entering the language. The Polish word kapote, for example, meaning long coat, is the same word in Polish and Yiddish. It was in Poland in the 16th century that there appeared one of the earliest and most important works of Yiddish literature, the Cena Urena.
I, Jacob ben Isaac Ashkenazi of Jano, am the author of the Cena Urena. In it I retold the book of Exodus in Yiddish, drawing upon Jewish literature, the Talmud, the Midrashim, books of legends and stories, and leading Jewish commentaries. My book became extremely popular among Jewish women because it enabled them to share in the religious and cultural life of their people. It taught them Jewish history and ethics. I wrote the book in Yiddish because I wanted ordinary people to understand the scriptures without interpreters or preachers. I could not have been more delighted when I saw my book in every Jewish home and knew that from my book, every Saturday, Jewish mothers read stories to their children.
Come here, children. There's a story I want to read to you from the Cena Urena. Pharaoh appointed officers over the Israelites to tax them because he did not wish to tax them himself, in order not to show how he hated them. The rabbis say he wore a brick around his neck, and whenever a Hebrew complained that he could not work, then Pharaoh would point to the brick around his neck and say, "Why dost thou deem thyself better than the king, who also maketh bricks?" Thus Pharaoh deceived Israel. At the completion of the first day's work, at eventide, Pharaoh ordered a count of the number of bricks made during the day, and saw that there were many, for on the first day the people were strong and had made a great many bricks. And for that purpose he appointed taskmasters to count the number of bricks made every day. And when the number was short, he ordered that the overseers be punished because they had failed to drive the workmen hard enough. But the overseers, who were Israelites, suffered stripes rather than betray the workmen who were short of the number assigned to them, lest those workmen be punished. Therefore, the overseers merited to be among the Sanhedrin that ruled Israel, and be among the 70 elders in Egypt who, with Moses, saw all the miracles performed before Pharaoh. From this, our sages infer that he who suffers for Israel's sake shall merit honor and high esteem.
A typical story from the Tzenu Urema, the first popular Jewish bestseller. From Poland, we migrated eastward to Russia, or rather, Russia migrated westward to us, for Russia annexed that part of Poland where many Jews were living.
Hello. I am applying for permission to change my place of residence to...
You'll have to see the chnovnik over there.
Good afternoon, sir. I am applying for permission to move my place of residence from...
You'll have to see the chnovnik over there for application for permission.
Good afternoon. I am applying for an application.
Weren't you just told just here a moment ago?
Yes, sir.
And didn't I send you to the chnovnik over there?
Yes, sir. But he sent me back to you. He said...
I don't care what he said. You must see the chnovnik over there before you can see me. Actually, you should see another chnovnik before you see either of us.
Oh, dear. Isn't there some simpler way I can acquire the permission needed to change my place of residence?
Well, since you mentioned it, actually there is a simpler way.
You mean crossing the palm with silver? But that is what you mean, isn't it? You want money.
Remember, you were the one who suggested it. I never mentioned it. It was all your idea.
And so, the word Shtotnik entered the Yiddish language. We used it to mean a petty official capable of being bribed. When we came to America, English words became part of the Yiddish language, and vice versa. The Yiddish word for subway became subway, spelled with Hebrew letters, but pronounced the same as in English. Well, almost the same. Many Yiddish words enter the English language. Schlepp is a Yiddish word often used in English. It's a word whose meaning can easily be told by its sound.
You carry a bouquet of flowers.
But you schlep a huge bundle tied with strings.
You take one child to the zoo.
But you schlep the whole family.
You travel to Paris.
But you schlep to Brooklyn.
To schlep actually means to drag. And in the noun form of the word, a schlep is a drag.
Before World War II, 11 million of us spoke Yiddish. It was our lingua franca, or common language. We were able to travel all over the world and find citizens of any country who were Jewish and to whom we could speak Yiddish, from northern Canada to southern Chile, from Bergen in Norway to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. We could keep abreast of world developments no matter where we were, because there were fine Yiddish newspapers published in almost all the major cities of Europe, the United States, Canada, Latin America, and even Australia.
We were also able to read novels, short stories, and poetry published in Yiddish reviews and magazines.
We could even visit Yiddish theaters in Europe, America, and South America.
As a result of the Nazi Holocaust and Russian persecution, this was radically changed. The golden age of Yiddish language and literature in the 19th and early 20th centuries seemed at an end. With Hebrew, the official language of Israel, even the establishment of a Jewish homeland seemed to forebode bad days for Yiddish.
What did we tell you? We told you that your days were numbered.
A dying language.
Do you have to rub it in? It makes me so depressed just to think about it. After all, I've been speaking Yiddish for over 1,000 years. It's such a rich, colorful, beautiful language. More important, it's my language. What's this? What are you two men doing here?
We're working on the Great Yiddish Dictionary.
The Great Yiddish Dictionary?
Yes, we're two of the editors. When it's finished, it'll be the definitive dictionary of the Yiddish language.
When will it be finished?
We expect to complete all 10 volumes by 1995.
We've been working on it since 1952. We've already published the first 2 volumes.
But if Yiddish is a dying language...
Who said so? There's more interest in Yiddish now than there's been in years.
When you are finished, how many words will the Great Yiddish Dictionary contain?
Over 200,000 words. Hmm.
How does that compare with the vocabularies of other languages?
It shows Yiddish to have about the same number of words as French, Russian, Spanish, and Italian.
Actually, Yiddish has fewer words than other languages in scientific, technical, and military vocabularies.
But it has more words in other areas of expression, religion, personal and social relations, morality, ethics, intellect, and feeling.
No, no, it's not Über. It's Iber. Iber. Iber der ganze Welt retten Yiddish. Now repeat that, please.
Iber der ganze Welt retten Yiddish.
Now I'll write some sentences on the blackboard, which I would like you to copy in your notebooks.
Oh, what is this? What's going on?
Oh, it's class in Yiddish.
Oh, excuse me. I don't want to interrupt.
Oh, that's all right. You're welcome to join us. I'm sure the teacher won't mind. Yeah.
May I ask you a question, young lady?
Of course.
Why are you studying Yiddish?
Well, I got married recently.
Oh, mazel tov.
Thank you.
And your husband insisted on your learning Yiddish?
Oh, no, not at all. It was my own idea. You see, I decided that before raising a family, I should learn Yiddish in order to be able to teach it to my children later on.
You believe it's necessary for your children to know Yiddish?
Necessary? No. A good thing, yes. I feel Yiddish is a unifying force for Jewish family life, and it will help give my children good moral values.
So, it's not as bad as they told me. There is continued interest in Yiddish. People attending lectures, Yiddish authors being widely read. The great Yiddish dictionary. Young people studying Yiddish in schools. Oh, maybe it'll never have the popularity it had before the Second World War, but I'm convinced that it'll never die. There was a poet I once knew, Abraham Leeson, who came here to America from Lithuania in 1897. Shortly before he died in New York in 1938, he wrote a poem that was a tribute to the Yiddish language. Later, the poem was set to music and made into a beautiful song. It tells why the Yiddish language can never die, why it will always be with us. The poem is called Yiddish.
From Worms, from Mainz, from Speyer, from Prague and Lublin till Odessa, stretched a chain like one current of fire, a miraculous chain forged in stress. And while hungry predators kept vigil behind death's thousand prowling eyes, I was sorrowfully there with all your forefathers, escorting their tragic demise. I have walked with them for centuries through multitudes of danger and sucked in the ashes of anger and pain in every flavor. And from these passing generations forged this marvel of will and despair. A life lived by Holy Torah, a faith even death cannot impair.
A Leben mit heiliger Teures und Sterben mit Festkeit versehen.
If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 25 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York, New York, 10027. And now we take great pleasure in presenting Rabbi I. Usher Kirschblum, spiritual leader of the Jewish Center of Kew Gardens Hills, Flushing, New York. Rabbi Kirschblum.
Yiddish, born in Germany over 1,000 years ago, was adopted by the Jew in the diaspora as his primary language. Before the dispersion, Hebrew was the Jew's day-to-day language. But with the passing of time, he began to revere it as his Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, and reserved it exclusively for his thrice daily prayers. Hebrew, forgotten by the large masses, became the language of the scholars. The average Jew no longer understood the Bible in its original tongue, nor was he able to comprehend the many beautiful and touching prayers contained in his very rich and poetic liturgy. Yiddish became his mamalushin, his mother tongue, and like a true mother, she kept her children united under her roof. From her breast they were fed courage and hope. Unto her bosom they fled from a hostile world and found in it shelter and strength. In her lap they spun beautiful dreams of an Israel reborn. And from her melodious voice they learned to sing the sweet lullabies of Zion. With the rise of the state of Israel, Hebrew reborn began to flourish again. Still revered as the holy tongue, it was completely revived as the spoken language of the Israelis. Today, Yiddish, quite satisfied to take second place to, but not be completely replaced by Hebrew, pleads to her many children throughout the world whom she had nurtured for so many years. Vergesst mich nicht. Do not forsake me. We ought to hearken to her, please. Through her rich literature created by Mendel, Peretz, Shalom Aleichem, to mention but a few of its immortal authors, Jewish life within and most certainly without Israel can be greatly enriched. Let us learn to read and write Yiddish. Let us incorporate many of its intransliterable idioms into our everyday speech. Yiddish is the one golden chain which can link together the young and the old generations. It is the one medium which can bring together Jews from practically all the four corners of the earth. Lomer reden Yiddish. Therefore, let us learn to speak Yiddish.
Thank you, Rabbi Kirschblum. Eternal Life program today, The Mother Tongue, was written by Harold Flender and is the first in a series entitled A Yiddish Omnibus. Cantor David Putterman sang the liturgical introduction. In the cast were Gilbert Mack, Maurice Tarplin, Stefan Schnabel, Larry Keith, Alan Manson, James Monks, Martin Wolfson, Robert Dryden, James Dukas, Mildred Clinton, Marion Seldes, Beatrice Pons, Ida Reese-Merrin, and Martha Greenhouse. The narrator, Norman Rose. We invite you to join us next week for the second program in this series, Harold Flinder's Portraits of a People, with a delightful array of selections from Yiddish literature. This is Jerry Damon. The Eternal Light is directed by Kenneth McGregor and is presented weekly under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the NBC Radio Network.